Okay, we're being
way to start off
recorded.
Yes, it is 12 noon, and certainly more jokes are welcome, but welcome to everyone to the CMDA meeting for today, December 6th, 2022, our last monthly meeting of the year. So we appreciate you all being here. I'm Singh Palat, the president of CMDA, and we'll go ahead and start with our agenda. I forgot to check, is Chad on the call?
This is Les Reitman, just checking in.
Hello, Les. Thanks for joining us today.
Good.
Would we like to start with Jenny? I can stop sharing my screen. I know that Jenny's got some slides prepared for us for our education.
Okay. And I once learned how to make this a presenter view. Let's see if I can do it again. Oh, that is not correct.
Ooh. That looks good.
Sure. Yeah.
There we go. You all should be able to see the slides and then I get to see my notes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, first off, I understand that most folks are probably very well aware of the trends in COVID, but I wanted to hit some highlights because we don't all get to see the same data slides and graphs all the time. So these are the ones that are most salient to me, and I hope that they are to you as well. So first off, this is just the global picture of the New York Times snapshot of our rates of infection in the last 90 days. We are still on an increased trajectory. And of course, you can see those gaps in the bars. That means, of course, that CDPHE does not release their data for everybody to pull during those timeframes. So we end up with these yo-yo spikes that you see in the bars, but that's why the line graph is more beneficial. And then, of course, we're not only trending up in COVID, but we're seeing our abnormally high flu rates, which we're all watching with bated breath at this point. The benefit to this, oddly, is that a lot of our counties are in high, which reverses our progress in getting out of COVID mitigation strategies, which brings a lot of heart palpitations down in my arena, and I think probably in yours as well. We are still supposed to be wearing masks everywhere that we are in high. So as troubled as we were to see our mitigation strategies decline and then all of the infection rates accelerate simultaneously, here's what we should be doing. This is my quick reference, and you all are welcome to this at any time. And of course, you'll have this in the slides. If you're in high transmission, and that's for the healthcare transmission, which is what was on the previous slide, then they even go so far as to say you should consider still doing eye protection and N95 for healthcare professionals. Residents are supposed to be masking, and visitors are recommended to be masking. You, of course, cannot force a visitor to mask, but we're asking them to do so. Of course, most of our buildings are half of our buildings are experiencing outbreaks right now as well. So that ups the ante even further. We just should really be masking. So our 7-day average positivity, according to the state, and this was up through the end of November, was still ranging really high, even considering that we're not really doing much surveillance testing. And this doesn't incorporate all the people that do at-home testing and test positive and don't report it, obviously. Most of us wouldn't be reporting that. And our particular age groups, 70 to 79 is the pink line and 80 plus is the brown line on the top. We, of course, are seeing the highest rates of infection. And then this gives you a snapshot of residential care. Outbreaks, I like to combine my own line graph with theirs to separate ALF and SNF with their global residential care outbreak count that you see in the bar graph below from the state. And then they also provide us with these daily case counts. And instead of adding yet another bar graph, I just included there 67% of the cases are currently residents. Which means even though we've constantly been holding this mantra of staff need to be vaccinated to prevent infection to residents, residents are seeing an accelerated rate of infection regardless of what we're seeing in the vaccination rates with staff at present. I'm going to get to what CMS is doing about this in just a minute. And of course, the question always is, well, infections, are they that severe? Are people symptomatic? Are we seeing mortality? And we really aren't. As of back in August, we started to see dissimilarity between case counts and mortality rates. That's when it stopped being so fatal in our environment. So you can see that general drop off in infection correlating to mortality there in the line graph, as well as the bar graph.
Let's see.
And yet we all know there are other consequences to infection. I just pulled this Reuters article here snippet because I thought this was fascinating. As much as we can't really argue consistency in symptoms and outcomes for long COVID, we can at least show that reinfection is causing pretty substantial risks to anybody who gets reinfected. Of course, our folks are particularly at risk, whether it's an increase in death and hospitalization risk or just general risks to pretty much all of your vital systems, as well as mental health and neurological disorders. This is our residential care vaccination rates in Colorado to the left. The reason why I put that up there is because we are currently going through a six-week push that the White House and CMS decided to produce with regard to resident booster uptake. And not just booster uptake, but actually primary vaccination as well. What we're finding is that there have been this group of people that are going through the hospital systems and then coming to us, and we're finding they are actually driving our total vaccination, primary vaccination rates and residents down nationwide in our setting. They're somehow people who slipped through the cracks, chose not to become vaccinated. So as well as we did at the beginning of the pandemic is saturating our population, we really are dealing with kind of catching up for those that didn't take care of themselves with vaccination in the community. So Biden administration and CMS do not like what they see. They want to see increased senior vaccination across the board. They're particularly focusing on nursing homes. The reason why this is interesting, our vaccination rates in Colorado are sort of above average for residents in SNF. In AL, they're far above average. 43% is the nationwide average in nursing homes. But there's a huge disparity between those that are well vaccinated and those that are under vaccinated, all the way down to 7.3% for a quarter of nursing homes not up to date on their resident vaccination. So the what this translates to for us in our communities is that surveyors are now being told to totally focus on this when they come in. So they used to specifically survey to vaccination procedures, and then they kind of got to back off on that. And now they still can sort of back off on it, but they're supposed to validate that we are doing the education and offering of vaccination for our residents. And they are particularly being tasked with spending more time looking at this issue in facilities where their vaccination rates are reported as lower than the 43% average. So the way they get this is through the national database, the NHSN reporting. Facilities receive deficiencies if they fail to report to NHSN timely. So everybody should be pretty well up to date on their reporting, but we're asking people to re-examine their NHSN reporting because the up-to-date terminology on question number 5 on the NHSN has been updated at the end of September, and they failed to really tell anybody about it until a few weeks have gone by. So we may have some erroneous data going from September to about late October. So take a peek at that if you're curious about it at your communities. And then this is another area that has not slacked off in focus. In fact, our new requirements of participation include some additional guidance on unnecessary medications with regard to antipsychotics. This HHS and OIG report came out hoping to raise the alarm again on this age-old issue, perennial problem. It's like a chronic condition. Skilled nursing operators continue to administer anticonvulsants, mood stabilizers, and central nervous system agents as less monitored types of psychotropic drugs. And then, of course, 80% of nursing home residents between 2011 and 2019 were prescribed a psychotropic drug. The reason why I'm mentioning all these other medications is, first of all, they are used to placate patients, typically, is what the data is showing. If there's fewer RN hours, if there are fewer staff hours, if it's a lower income, more Medicaid-funded environment, they're seeing a correlation between higher psychotropic use and those environments. And so they have decided in the new requirements of participation surveyor guidance to really crack down on this. The new guidance indicates that other medications are now subject to the same requirements if use appears to be a substitution for a psychotropic medication. So take a peek at your prescribers. Here's the survey trends. Everybody always wants to know this question of me, and I'm sure Chad will touch on this. I saw him join. He provided me with this information, so I'm sure he will touch on it. The main thing here that for takeaway is that nurse staffing and psychosocial outcomes for residents can really drive a severity of deficiency citation and can really propel a survey into a negative direction. So pay attention to the staffing and how it is impacting whether your residents feel they are taken care of, because it is a lot about perception. I have a couple of good notes to close us out with my last couple of slides. There is a new fund out there that's been released for us to draw people back into the healthcare workforce. So essentially, if you know your community has let somebody go back out of the healthcare workforce, but they're still a licensed professional, therapist, nurse, CNA, the community can qualify for a $20,000 bonus, basically, per professional re-engaged in the healthcare workforce. So they don't tell us how to use that $20,000. They simply want it to be specifically for getting folks re-engaged in the healthcare workforce in the long-term care facility environment. There are a couple of critical shortage and pediatric serving areas that are also included in this, but for our interest, this is a pretty significant amount of money, and it can help to retain that individual. It can help to build further hiring practices. It's very useful money if there is anybody waiting in the wings. And then the last couple of things here, I am launching a DON support pod program in January. It sounds a little funny. Basically, I've been hearing from my members that the turnover and burnout for DONs particularly is the worst of all the leadership positions. And I witnessed that myself. So apparently it has not changed. It's simply gotten exacerbated with COVID. And they don't think more education, mental health resources, or just vacation is the answer. They want validation and companionship to help walk through their day-to-day. And so we are coming up with these small groups. There'll be weekly meetings for a minimum of a 6-month period under the supervision of a guide, someone who is an experienced director of nursing or someone who has led directors of nursing. We're hoping to do 5 to 10 groups to start with and monitor to see if it really does help people feel supported. It's a half an hour little meeting virtually once a week. And these guides will undergo specific training on leadership development through Telegen. They have some Harvard-trained concepts that they want to produce for folks. And then also using learning circle methodology from the Eden Alternative. So we hope that this is going to be exciting for people to join and feel a little bit more of an outreach and support from their colleagues. And last but not least, this is our upcoming education. I'll let you kind of peruse that. I think probably the greatest interest to you is the one that's dead center. We are developing a behavioral health needs series. We're starting with an in-person training in Colorado Springs, led by multiple social work and psych experts to talk about how we have to reintegrate our communities now that our populations have such disparate needs for behavioral health and substance use needs. So that's been many, many times asked for. Any questions for me?
Jenny, thank you so much for this variety of very relevant and timely updates. We always appreciate having you here in CHCA. Maybe if there are other questions, we can take them after chat even. I saw Chad jump on, and Chad Fear, CDPHE Nursing Facilities Section Manager. Thank you for bringing your updates today too. Go ahead.
All right, you bet. I just have a short list for today's meeting. You know, as Jenny had mentioned in her slides, you know, we are seeing really a correlation between staffing issues, supervision, and psychosocial adverse outcomes, leading to, in particular, you know, immediate jeopardy and harm level tags. So in addition to the, you know, the higher likelihood that something will be cited for division practice, we're seeing those adverse outcomes as well. You know, we try to do everything we can to keep the failure identified in their area. But when you start to see the patterns, that, and maybe it's more than just one area that is associated with the you know, the correlation with the staffing issues, then, you know, we have a greater, I think, obligation to, you know, take a deeper dive into the staffing issues and to more fully understand this as a facility practice or a pattern, and to, you know, unfortunately at those times, have to, you know, also cite staffing, you know, and we certainly try to be as understanding as possible, because we know everybody is struggling with staffing, and we wouldn't want to go around and cite everybody for, you know, for something that is so prevalent. But when we do see the outcomes, then it leads to that greater concern. For ourselves, we continue to work on our backlog of recertification surveys. We've had some help, I think we mentioned in past meetings, from a contract survey agency. And we've made some progress. We've had a bit of turnover for ourselves, and we've been able to make some hires. So we're proud about the hires. When we've had folks leave us, you know, they're leaving us with 9 months or a year or 2 years of skill development and experience. And so it takes, you know, it's not a one-for-one situation. It takes a little while to bring people up to speed and be, you know, contributing team members. When we go out and we do those surveys, we've been out with CMS doing resource support surveys and federal oversight surveys as well. So we get surveyed on survey sometimes by the you know, by our regional office, and you know, to date, fortunately, we've had some pretty good outcomes with that. I think CMS has agreed with our findings by and large. You know, it's always nice to have another perspective when you go out, so that you can, you know, that other set of eyes that look for opportunities for education or improvement within ourselves. So we're constantly looking to, you know, to do a better job. Just to also bring to your attention two more things. We are going to be sharing stakeholder engagement flyers. So we're doing rulemaking around dementia training and visitation. And so those flyers will be going out, soliciting more engagement, more participation by stakeholders in those meetings that we'll have. And also, just to let you know that at the upcoming nursing home roundtable meeting, and this will be the March meeting, we will have a presentation by another section here with CDPHE, and they're going to discuss at length immunizations. And so, you know, we hear a lot about COVID, right? I mean, for a long time. But these, I believe this presentation will go in a little bit different direction, talking about influenza, pneumococcal, shingles, and that kind of, you know, protection, I guess, if you will, against those other kinds of things. As Jenny had indicated, and I think as we've seen as a trend, influenza has it's skyrocketing, I guess, if you will, in terms of the infection rate. So some more information there. If you do not normally attend the nursing home roundtable meeting and you would like to attend, please go ahead and forward me your email address, and I'll make sure you get on that that distribution and invitation list. And we meet the first Tuesday of every other month from 9:30 to 11:30.
Thank you, Chad. Thanks for inviting our CMDA members to that. And if anyone didn't catch it, you know, go ahead and reach out to Chad or reach out to me, and we'll make sure that you can represent our group at the Nursing Home Roundtable for the CDPHE. Thank you for your updates, Chad. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
Our next speaker today is Dr. Mike McDermott. He is the director of endocrinology and diabetes practice at the University of Colorado. And I just learned that he is also the president-elect of the American Thyroid Association. So we're so honored to have you here today, Dr. McDermott. And I know that you have prepared some slides for us on hyperthyroidism. That's hyper with a P-E-R at the end of it. And so thank you very much. I just made you a co-host. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for being here. And I'm wondering, are you going to pull up the slides, I think, from your end, right?
Right. Yep.
Okay. Sure will. Thank you.
Okay. Can you see my slides okay?
Yes.
I can see them.
Okay. Yes. Are they? All right. Well, thank you for asking me. I'm pleased to be able to speak with you today, and hopefully we can share some ideas and learn from some of the things you've learned about thyroid disease in elderly people. Thyroid disease is common. 10% of the population have hypothyroidism, one out of every 10 people, and one out of every 50 people has hyperthyroidism. But those numbers increase significantly in the elderly. The cause of the hyper and hypothyroidism changes in the elderly, and the clinical manifestations can be quite different in elderly people. So with that in mind, Dr. Hebert asked me if I would speak about hyperthyroidism, and there's just a couple of words on hypothyroidism at the end. You all know how to screen for thyroid function testing. There's a difference, of course, between screening and case finding. Screening is when you go to the health fair and just get a TSH for no reason, or you do it because someone is, you know, a certain age. But case finding is when you have symptoms and you're looking for something. So there's a slightly different approach. If the TSH is low, that person most likely has thyrotoxicosis. If the TSH is low, we recommend measuring a free T4 and a total T3. These are the best tests to determine if a person is making only T4, only T3, or both. If the TSH is high, that person most likely has hypothyroidism. You don't need a T3 because T3 is relatively preserved. The main test you would want is a free T4 to see if it's overt or subclinical. So we're going to talk mainly about thyrotoxicosis on the left side here. When you diagnose someone with thyrotoxicosis, by virtue of first finding a low TSH, the first thing to do is determine the severity. Is it mild, subclinical? Is it severe? So we do, that's where the free T4 and the total T3 come in. If the T4 and or the T3 is frankly elevated above the reference range, we call that overt thyrotoxicosis. If the TSH is low, but T4 and T3 are still within the population reference range, even though they may be higher for that person than they used to be, which is why their TSH is low, still, if it's in the population range, we call that subclinical thyrotoxicosis. The next thing that you want to do is determine the cause. So there are a number of causes. The first step is physical exam, because the different types of thyroid disease have very distinct physical findings, especially involving the thyroid gland and the eyes, for example. So people with Graves' disease typically will have a diffuse goiter. It feels very vascular. I tell our fellows it's a spongy feeling gland that's diffusely enlarged. The orbitopathy, where people's eyes are bulging out, that only occurs in Graves' disease. And pretibial myxedema, a rash on the shins, only occurs in Graves' disease. So you already know, with a high likelihood, if a person has a diffuse goiter in orbitopathy, they probably have Graves' disease. If these Graves' signs are absent, or there's no nodules, you still don't know what the disease is, you're not sure if it's Graves' disease or not, the best test to identify what the cause is the thyrotropin receptor antibody test. That's the most sensitive and specific test for Graves' disease. If that's positive, that person has Graves' disease. If the TRAB test is negative, or the person has nodules, the next step is to do a radioactive iodine uptake and scan. some of you in this room may have spent time with me when I was at Fitzsimmons or since then in our thyroid clinic. And we always did a radio iodine uptake and scan on people with hyperthyroidism. But nowadays, you don't really need to if the thyrotropin receptor antibodies are positive. That's Graves' disease. You're done. You don't need any nuclear medicine studies. It's when TRAb is negative or thyroid nodules are present that you should do an uptake and a scan. If the uptake is elevated, they still may have Graves' disease. They may have a toxic multinodular goiter, or they may have a toxic nodule. And the scan is going to tell you which one of those it is when you look at the actual picture. If the radioactive iodine uptake is low, that's the various types of thyroiditis or the thyroid disease we get from taking amiodarone or large doses of iodine or factitious thyrotoxicosis when people are taking exogenous thyroid hormone, either known or unknown, in excess amounts. So to circle back on the specific features of Graves' disease, the exophthalmos, the stare, the periorbital edema that we see in this patient are very characteristic of Graves' disease. It doesn't occur in any other type of hyperthyroidism. When the TRAb are negative, we rely on the radioactive iodine uptake and scan to help us. The types of thyrotoxicosis that are associated with an elevated radioactive iodine uptake, meaning a very overactive thyroid gland, are Graves' disease, toxic multinodular goiter, and toxic solitary nodules. TSH-producing tumors are rare. HCG-producing tumors are rare in older people, but they may occur in younger people. So that's the differential diagnosis of thyrotoxicosis if you've gotten a radioactive iodine uptake and found it to be elevated. If the radioactive iodine uptake is low, and remember, we're only doing this test if the TRAb, the thyrotropin receptor antibodies, are negative. If the radioiodine uptake is low, the most common cause is postpartum thyroiditis. You would know if a person's really recently had a pregnancy. Silent thyroiditis or subacute thyroiditis, which is tender and is associated with fever and an elevated sedimentation rate. But this is a common also presentation of amiodarone-induced thyrotoxicosis, and there's two types of that, and iodine-induced, where a person with a previous non-toxic multinodular goiter gets an iodine load. It can be from a radiologic procedure, a cardiac catheterization, or iodine load from any reason, and the iodine produces hyperthyroidism. And then we've got factitious. Now, some people are just taking too much thyroid hormone, and we know that. But there are other people who don't even know they're taking thyroid hormone. There are a number of weight loss products that actually contain thyroid hormone, and people don't necessarily even know they're taking it. Tests that are sometimes needed, the TRAb is negative and you still don't know after doing your nuclear medicine studies, a TPO antibody, a serum thyroglobulin, a SED rate, and an ultrasound. Generally, if you still don't know what the diagnosis is, one of these tests will help you determine the type of thyrotoxicosis. Now, when thyrotoxicosis is associated with an elevated radioactive iodine uptake, that means that the thyroid gland is taking up iodine, producing thyroid hormone, and secreting it in excessive amounts. This is what the term hyperthyroidism means. The term hyperthyroidism actually only refers to the types of thyrotoxicosis where the gland itself is overactive, taking up iodine and producing thyroid hormone. These are people that you need to do a scan. So the uptake is a number. It tells you what percent of the iodine was taken up. For example, 30%. Okay, that would be the uptake. The thyroid scan will then tell you what the underlying disorder is. And what we'll look at is, well, does the scan show diffuse uptake, or does it show patchy uptake or solitary uptake? So here's an example of diffuse uptake. This is Graves' disease, and this is caused by these TSH receptor antibodies, so that the entire gland is overactive. Every cell is stimulated. Every cell is overactive. A bit more common in older people is a toxic multinodular goiter, and that's where the scan will show areas of high uptake in areas of low uptake. So it's called patchy uptake. These people actually have mutations in these overactive nodules that cause them to be overactive. And then there's a solitary thyroid nodule where one nodule becomes very big and produces so much thyroid hormone that the person's TSH is suppressed and the rest of the gland doesn't show up at all. These are also due to some activating mutations that we don't need to go into. Now, if you have negative TRAb and you do a radioactive iodine uptake and it's low, as I mentioned, the differential diagnosis are these three types of thyroiditis. You don't need to do a scan because the gland won't take up the scanning material. You've already shown by low iodine uptake that it's not going to take up the technetium that you give for a thyroid scan. These three types of thyroiditis are called destructive thyroiditis. The thyroid gland is inflamed. It's spilling out thyroid hormone that's already been synthesized and is stored in the gland to be secreted at another date. And when the gland becomes inflamed, it spills out that thyroid hormone. So these are all self-limited. T4 and T3 spill into the circulation and the person has thyrotoxicosis until the gland has spilled out all of its thyroid hormone, and then people develop hypothyroidism. So the clinical course of postpartum, silent, and subacute thyroiditis look like this. The gland becomes inflamed and it spills out its stored thyroid hormone, so the T4 level becomes elevated. And as the T4 level becomes elevated, the TSH is suppressed. So they look like typical thyrotoxicosis. But it's really not due to overactive thyroid gland. It's due to the thyroid gland spilling out its stored hormone. Once a gland becomes depleted of its stored hormone, the free T4 actually develops, becomes low, and the TSH becomes high. So they transition from a transient period, 1 to 3 months of thyrotoxicosis, into a longer period of hypothyroidism that may last anywhere from 3 to 6 months of hypothyroidism. And then about 75 to 80% of people return to a euthyroid state, 20 to 25% remain permanently hypothyroid. The treatment for Graves' disease typically involves antithyroid drugs for 12 to 18 months. Methimazole is our favored drug in this regard. It's given, it only needs to be given once a day, and it has a much lower incidence of side effects than propylthiouracil, and it's much stronger. The initial dose of methimazole, all of our fellows find this table that I send out to them at the beginning of the year very useful. If the free T4 is 1 to 1.5 times the upper limit of normal, the dose of methimazole is 5 to 10 milligrams. The free T4 is 1.5 to 2 times the upper limit of normal, the dose of methimazole is 10 to 20. And if it's greater than 2 to 3 times the upper limit, the dose of methimazole is 30 to 40. Generally, it can be given once a day because it has a long intrathyroidal half-life. Typically, after 1 to 2 months, we reduce the dose, usually by 50%, because the dose required to maintain euthyroidism is a lot less than the dose required to achieve euthyroidism. We usually start people on a beta blocker because it's the quickest way to get rid of the symptoms of thyrotoxicosis, but we don't keep the beta blocker on indefinitely. Once the person has returned to euthyroidism on methimazole, we stop the beta blocker. The goal is quick symptom relief. If you treat people for 12 to 18 months, 50% of people with Graves' disease will develop a remission and you can stop the medication. The side effects, methimazole can elevate the alkaline phosphatase. Propylthiouracil, however, is the third leading cause of drug-induced liver failure, and that's why we prefer methimazole over propylthiouracil. Either drug can cause agranulocytosis. It's rare. It happens in about 1 out of every 200 patients, and it's much less common. It almost never occurs on doses of methimazole, 30 milligrams or less. But when people get it, they develop a fever and a sore throat. And so we counsel people, if they're on methimazole or propylthiouracil, that if you develop a high fever or a sore throat, stop your medicine and go get a CBC. If you diagnose agranulocytosis and stop the medication quickly, it resolves in almost all patients. But if you don't stop the medicine, it can become a chronic problem. The other options for Graves' disease are radioactive iodine. A person takes a thimbleful of water that has radioactive iodine in it. This destroys the thyroid gland. The goal is not euthyroidism. If the treatment works, 80 to 100% of people develop hypothyroidism. So it's not a situation where this will prevent you from having to take a medicine for the rest of your life. These people almost always develop hypothyroidism. Thyroidectomy is the other choice, and about 80 to 100% of people develop hypothyroidism after thyroidectomy, because with Graves' disease, the entire gland, or at least 80% of it, needs to be removed. Now, toxic multinodular goiters are a bit more common in elderly people than Graves' disease is. Although Graves' disease still occurs, the toxic multinodular goiter and the toxic solitary nodule actually are more common. And these are not autoimmune diseases like Graves' disease, and they never go into remission. So we can use antithyroid drugs or radioactive iodine or thyroidectomy, but we choose a little bit differently. For example, we usually want to do definitive treatment with radioactive iodine or thyroidectomy, but before a person can have those therapies, we want them to be euthyroid. So we start them on methimazole for 4 to 6 weeks prior to giving radioiodine or surgery. Now, some people may not want radioiodine or thyroidectomy, and so chronic low-dose methimazole therapy is also an acceptable way to treat a toxic multinodular goiter, typically 10 milligrams a day, maybe 5 milligrams in some people chronically, maybe how you want to treat these patients. But that disease will never go into remission like Graves' disease does. If you give radioactive iodine, the radiation is concentrated in the toxic nodules and not the whole gland. So only 50% of people develop hypothyroidism with toxic multinodular goiters. With a thyroidectomy, they don't usually take the whole gland out. So only about 50% develop hypothyroidism. The monitoring, we always check labs 4 to 6 weeks after we start a therapy, and then 3 months later, and then generally every 6 to 12 months thereafter. Destructive thyroiditis, the postpartum, the silent, and the subacute thyroiditis are treated completely differently. So during the thyrotoxic phase, remember that the thyroid gland is not making thyroid hormone. It's only spilling out thyroid hormone it's already made. So methimazole and propylthiouracil are not effective because they work by inhibiting thyroid hormone synthesis. We use beta blockers to treat their symptoms. We use nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs or steroids if they have pain, like they often do with subacute thyroiditis, but the anti-thyroid drugs are not effective. So we don't use methimazole or propylthiouracil during the thyrotoxic phase of these three types of thyroiditis. During the hypothyroid phase, we often will give people a temporary course of levothyroxine if they're symptomatic. If the hypothyroid phase is very mild, the TSH of 8, for example, you may not need to treat that and just ride it out. It'll eventually resolve. Again, most people with these types of thyroiditis return to normal, but some remain permanently hypothyroid. Subclinical thyrotoxicosis is approached a bit differently. So what's going on here? So I just show you here the normal range for free T4. It goes from 0.8 to 1.8. And what that tells you is that you can double the lower end of normal and still be within the normal range. So there's a very large, even though it looks kind of narrow, twice the lower end still doesn't exceed the upper end. So in this case, somebody's thyroid hormone may have been in the middle of the normal range. Their gland became slightly overactive. Their T4 increased. The pituitary sensed that and stopped making TSH. So subclinical thyrotoxicosis means a low TSH, but a free T4 and total T3 that are still within the reference range. Another word for this is just mild thyrotoxicosis. Now, what are the risks of subclinical thyrotoxicosis? And in younger people, there's very little risk, and most don't have symptoms. The risks are mainly seen in people over age 60. And those risks of subclinical thyrotoxicosis are atrial fibrillation, osteoporosis, and increased mortality rate. Here's a study from 1994 that looked at about 2,000 subjects. They measured their TSH. They followed up for 10 years. Some of these were normal. Some were on thyroid hormone. But they did show that people who had a TSH that was suppressed, these are over age 60, had a threefold increased risk of developing atrial fibrillation. And even with a mildly low serum TSH, there was a 60% increase in atrial fibrillation compared to people who were completely euthyroid. There's multiple studies that have duplicated those findings. In terms of osteoporosis, I didn't want to go through the individual studies because there's 15 of them. All 15 looked at women. 5 also included men. Some were cross-sectional, some longitudinal, some retrospective. Across the board, they showed that a suppressed TSH of any cause, whether it's endogenous, meaning the thyroid gland is overactive, or from someone who's just taking too much thyroid hormone, suppressed TSH is associated with a significant increase in the risk of fragility fractures. Levothyroxine therapy is not associated with fractures if the TSH is maintained within the normal range. So it's really a matter of whether the person is being overtreated or not. And then mortality. This is a pooled analysis of 52,000 subjects, 10 cohorts. Over 2,000 had endogenous thyrotoxicosis. The mortality rate increased by 24%. Coronary heart disease mortality rate increased 29%. Mortality from atrial fibrillation or associated with AFib increased 68%. And those were all significant. So subclinical thyrotoxicosis may not be really subclinical in people over age 60. It might have some consequences. So the consensus recommendations are these, and I think these are good and they've been vetted pretty well. Subclinical thyrotoxicosis, where the TSH is below the normal range, but still detectable, in other words, between 0.1 and 0.45, consider treating them if they have hyperthyroid symptoms, if their age is greater than 65, if they have cardiac risk factors, or they have osteoporosis. If the TSH is less than 0.1, strongly consider, so just a stronger recommendation, the same people with symptoms over age 65, cardiac risk factors, or osteoporosis. There's no recommendation for treating people whose TSH is still within the normal range because that still is considered normal. How do we treat subclinical hyperthyroidism? Generally, with a low dose of methimazole, 5 milligrams a day is usually enough. You may need 10 milligrams to start with, but usually you're going to maintain them on 5 or even 2.5 milligrams a day. Recheck their TSH in 4 to 8 weeks. You titrate their dose until you get their TSH within and free T4 within the reference range. Now, we found out some interesting things about the elderly population, that in very healthy elderly people, the TSH distribution curve is shifted to the right, so that normal elderly people over age 80, their average TSH is about 2.4, whereas it's about 1.7 in younger people, and more people in the that are normal above age 80 have, frankly, slightly elevated serum TSH levels. So we know that shift curves to the right, and it turns out that this is not a hazard to have a slightly elevated TSH level. So keeping that in mind, when treating older people with hypothyroidism, the American Thyroid Association recommends that the TSH levels in elderly people who have hypothyroidism and you're treating with levothyroxine, that a reasonable goal is to have a TSH target of 4 to 6 milliunits per liter in people over age 70 to 80 being treated for hypothyroidism. And that's been interpreted occasionally to say, well, maybe a level of 3 or 2 in someone who is over age 70 and not on thyroid hormone, maybe that's indicative of thyrotoxicosis, but it's not. So thyrotoxicosis is defined as a low TSH. When treating someone for hypothyroidism, it's reasonable to set a slightly higher target than we do in younger people. So I've gone for about 25 minutes, and that was my intention to do that and then leave some time for questions. So I'm open for any questions you have.
Thank you, Dr. McDermott. That was really amazing. What a great background and interesting information about some of the newer information about the subclinical hyperthyroidism. So some of the labs in our local laboratory facilities that are sending lab reports to our providers do reference that higher TSH as being a target TSH for older adults, and even saying that it's a normal TSH, but it sounds like you're saying it's different based on your treatment goal, whether you're treating for hyper versus hypothyroidism.
Yeah, so that 4 to 6 is the target range for hypothyroid people that are being treated with levothyroxine. And it's not firm. It just says it's reasonable to set a slightly higher goal. It doesn't mean that a TSH of 2 or 3 and someone being treated for hypothyroidism is wrong. It also doesn't mean that a TSH lower than 4 is indicative of thyrotoxicosis. Thyrotoxicosis is still defined in elderly people as a TSH below the population reference range. And there's no data for atrial fibrillation, fractures, mortality, or any other adverse events for elderly people who have TSH levels within the normal range. It's only people that have a TSH that's frankly low. So subclinical thyrotoxicosis is still defined as a TSH less than the lower end of your normal range for the general population.
Dr. McDermott, Lee Annenberg here. I did share some of the literature with that regional lab, and they have changed their lab report and taken out that section that talked about 4 to 6. And so now that just cites the range from like 0.45 and up as being normal. And so that the lab director did respond and correct their misleading lab report on TSHs.
Well, see, by notifying them of that, you've done really a great service to a large number of people, I think. And that's where getting involved with this type of thing, I think, is really beneficial. Congratulations on doing that, Lee. I think that was a very important step. I brought this up. I was at the American Thyroid Association meeting not too long ago, and I asked some of my colleagues, you know, if anyone had encountered such a, you know, a lab report, and most were astounded that that would have happened to begin with.
Yes, thank you. And Dr. McDermott, there's a question in the chat box from Dr. Amy Moeller from Grand Junction. What is your opinion about using weekly levothyroxine dosing?
So it's been well demonstrated that for people that taking a daily dose is difficult, either because of their own adherence or for a variety of reasons, that people can either be given 7 doses one day a week or 3 to 4 doses twice a week under observation. We know that people with persistently elevated serum TSH levels, the main cause of that is non-adherence to their medication regimen. Everybody's always looking to see, do they have malabsorption? And most of them don't. Most of them just aren't taking their medicine. So there may be a reason to watch, to bring them into your office, or if they're in a nursing home, to go by and observe them take 7 tablets at once. So the studies that have looked at those regimens have monitored the serum TSH and T4 levels after doing that to see if they rise to dangerous levels after taking 7 pills at once. And actually, the T4 and the TSH curves are remarkably smooth. They tend to stay within the normal range. So these are not huge studies, but they're well-done studies in a population of you know, elderly people for whom this was an issue. And it shows that if people can't take their dose every day, they can take it, you know, 3 or 4 pills twice a week or 7 pills once a week, and they can do it safely.
Neat. Another question in the chat box from Travis Neal, PA. How do you see amiodarone affecting thyroid disease? Is it hyper or hypo? And if it is stopped, the amiodarone is stopped, how long would you continue to check the TSH?
So amiodarone does both. It causes hypothyroidism more commonly than it causes hyperthyroidism, but it can do either. Amiodarone has a very, very high content of iodine. And so the hypothyroidism is partly due to the high iodine content, and the hyperthyroidism is also due to the high iodine content in people who have underlying toxic or non-toxic multinodular goiters. Amiodarone, just like it has toxicity in the lung, it has toxicity directly to thyroid cells, and so it can cause a type of thyroiditis. So both the hypothyroidism and the hyperthyroidism are due to the high iodine content and the toxic effects of amiodarone on thyroid cells. So in the former case, they cause the thyroid cells to be underactive. In the latter case, amiodarone-induced thyrotoxicosis, they often cause a thyroiditis because the amiodarone is breaking apart the cells, or they cause an iodine-induced thyrotoxicosis. And the two of those are actually treated slightly differently, and the distinction between them is relatively difficult to make. But amiodarone-induced hypothyroidism is 2 to 3 times more common than hyper. So you see hypo actually more commonly.
Do you have any comments on the role of biotin over-the-counter supplements that could falsely lower the TSH due to interference of the lab test?
Right. So a lot of the immunoassays that we do, it's not just thyroid, but it's a lot of the other hormone assays and some drug assays also, use biotin in the test tube to allow the ligand that's being measured to bind to the matrix in the tube. And an exactly titrated amount of biotin is necessary for that to happen. If a person is taking biotin supplements that come just in a multivitamin, there's not enough biotin in a multivitamin to interfere. But when people are taking high doses of biotin for hair loss, for skin problems or nail problems, they often are taking like 500 to 5,000 times the amount of biotin that is present in a multivitamin. And these levels are so high that they actually interfere with the binding of TSH and thyroid hormone, also parathyroid hormone, cortisol, a lot of different hormones we measure. And they can give you very false results. And the most common set of thyroid labs in somebody on biotin is a high T4 and a low TSH and a positive TRAb. Looks just like Graves' disease, but you stop the biotin for 3 days and it all goes away. So if people are taking high doses of biotin, not a multivitamin, we ask them to stop their biotin for 3 days before they come in and get their hormones drawn or their labs drawn. Some of the labs run assays that are not affected by biotin, and they can tell you if that's the case, but many of the labs are affected by it. And so I think it's really critical when people are taking high-dose biotin, just to ask them, stop it for 3 days. It doesn't hurt your thyroid to be on it. It's not causing disease, but it's causing our tests to be wacky, and it's making us, you know, have false interpretations.
Oh, interesting. Thank you. We have 2 more minutes, and Dr. Kurt Weaver asked in the chat box, I have patients previously stable in long-term care settings who suddenly get a very high TSH. I assume they are getting their medications. What are your thoughts?
One would be that, you know, that they didn't get them or they're spitting them out. That happens. One might be, you know, that they may be malabsorbing. If people are on continuous tube feeds, you can't really give a person thyroid hormone on an empty stomach, for example. And so we know that food and other medications inhibit the absorption of thyroid hormone by anywhere from 30 to 40%. So it may be that the person is taking another medication that inhibits absorption or food, or they're on a continuous tube feed and they always have food in there. There are some medications like the anticonvulsants that increase the metabolism of thyroid hormone, so it doesn't stay around. So increased metabolism or malabsorption due to other drugs are some of the more common causes of a persistently elevated serum TSH. And if a person has had a recent illness, the TSH typically is suppressed during the illness, but during the recovery phase, it'll often rise to as high as 15 or 20 before it comes back to normal. So a person who's recently had urosepsis or pneumonia may transiently have an elevated TSH as they recover from what we call euthyroid 6 syndrome.
Wonderful. Yep, there is a lot of nuance to that, and we do see that commonly. Thank you, Dr. McDermott. Really appreciate you taking the time to provide this education to our audience.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking me, and hope you all have a great day.
Appreciate it. Thank you. We have one more speaker for today, and it's Leslie Williams-Anderson. She's a FNP, nurse practitioner with Optum, and she's here to present on this technique of hypodermoclysis. Leslie, would you like to share your slides?
Sure.
And while she's pulling up the slides, I'll make our final announcement from CMDA today, which is that we are, as a committee, working on the final draft of our educational agenda for the annual CMDA conference, which will be on Friday, April 28th in 2023. This year, it's going to be at the Denver PPA Event Center, which is where it was last year. We will have in-person and virtual options for people to attend, and you're all invited to come join us for a whole day of CME. Leslie Williams-Anderson.
Did that come up?
No, not yet. If you'd like, I can share it from my screen. Or who's, is it Leslie? Oh, Leslie, okay, Dr. McDermott, I think you're still sharing your slides. Maybe that's why. Let's see. Dr. McDermott, are you still on? Maybe you could stop sharing your slides so that Leslie could share hers.
I'm trying to exit, but
I think I forced you to. Sorry.
The leave button finally came up. Sorry, the leave button just wasn't visible. Now I got it.
No problem. I know that's really tricky. It disappears on you. Leslie, I have your slides pulled up. If you'd like to talk, I'll advance them for you.
Sure, this is just a short presentation on hypodermoclysis, which is, do you want to go ahead and run that for me?
You bet.
It's, the definition is, it's a method of infusing fluids subcutaneously in patients. It's very helpful in patients when there's difficulty in obtaining IV access. It's been around for a really long time. We just don't frequently utilize it. And we're starting to utilize it more in our facilities. So the reasoning behind hypodermoclysis would be, it's good for patients that are, you're wanting to reduce the need to send to the hospital for IV initiation. It decreases agitation and discomfort for patients due to potentially having to stick them multiple times. Also works well with patients with mild to moderate dehydration that are not able to take in enough orally to assist with hydration. And it works well with patients with short-term illnesses like gastroenteritis, diarrhea, vomiting, and patients that need that supplemental support during treatment of other secondary infections. So some of the people that this would be appropriate would be your dehydration patients, patients with difficulty obtaining IV access, poor PO intake, patients where your goal is palliative or comfort and a bowel obstruction. Obviously, the patients you would not want to use it on are those patients that are more acutely ill, seriously ill, like active cardiac events, septic shock, patients with severe electrolyte imbalances. You're not going to get correction of your electrolytes quick enough, severe heart failure patients, and acute TBIs. So the potential infusion sites are laterally abdominal. The lateral abdominal wall is most oftenly used. I will typically put it in the anterior upper thigh or the back behind the scapula, especially if you're dealing with patients with a little bit of dementia that are more likely to pull their IV out. Equipment used for cholecystectomy is just like you were initiating regular IV infusion. You can use a 23 to 25 gauge wing needle. You can also use a simple angiocath. You need infusion tube, betadine alcohol pads, infusion fluids, Tegaderm, and tape. Medications that are preferred to be used are normal saline. Typically, fluids you're not going to be using in the nursing home or assisted care setting anyway. So it would be normal saline, D5, D5 1/2, and D5LR. Initiation of for procedure for infusion is just like you would do a regular IV. You prime your IV tubing, cleanse the site with alcohol or betadine, with the bevel up of the needle, just like inserting an IV. You're inserting just deeper than you would for a TB, but not quite as not intramuscular. So a 45 to 60 degree angle would be appropriate. Secure the site utilizing the transparent dressing, attach your fluids, set the desired rate, time, and date it just like you would with a normal IV. You're going to monitor your site for erythema, pain, or persistent swelling. IV fluids can be infused at up to 75 cc's an hour. They're infused by gravity, or you can put it on a the dial. You can give approximately 3 liters. It can be given over 24 hours at 2 separate sites. And the infusion site should be checked, changed every 48 hours. So some of the things that we look for when we have placed hypodermoclysis in place is you could see localized edema. This typically resolves with gentle massaging at the site. And you're typically going to see it right at the beginning of the infusion. You're going to be looking for pain or discomfort, and that could be typically that you've either inserted the needle too deep, which actually you can just withdraw the needle slightly and re-tack it in place, or the infusion is too fast. So the recommendation is to start the infusion a little bit slower and monitor for 15 minutes. You could be see cellulitis at the site, but that's typically seen because of not utilizing aseptic techniques. So be sure to change your IV site every 48 hours. That's it. Any questions? Very simple procedure to put in place. We've been teaching the nurses on site how to do it, and they've been super receptive.
Thanks, Leslie. Thanks for drawing those parallels with sub-Q and IV fluids too.
You know, a suggestion I have is that when you're documenting the rationale for starting this, sometimes it's helpful to the facility to have you use the term maintenance of hydration, as opposed to documenting for all to see that the patient was dehydrated. And so unless it's very obvious from very abnormal labs, I would encourage you to use maintenance of hydration, with diarrhea or whatever this inciting illness is, and then not be digging a hole for the facility to have to dig back out from by documenting that they were dehydrated.
The other workaround is hypovolemia. And I've never had a facility run into trouble with a diagnosis of hypovolemia.
I've used that myself. Thank you. Great suggestions. Well, thank you so much. Appreciate all of our speakers today. If there are any questions, let's go ahead and shoot them over to us. We'll make sure you get an answer. Thanks for joining us for our monthly meeting. We don't have any meeting in January because it's right after the new year, and our next scheduled meeting will be Tuesday, February 7th. Have a good day, everybody.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.